This is the Taz and Jim Podcast.
Big weekend coming up in Brantford, Ontario. The return, the triumphant return of the one and only Kevin Smith. He joins us here on the Taz and Jim Show. How are you, Kevin?
Good morning, Taz. How are you, man? Good to see you. Actually see you. When I first started my career and I call into radio shows, you never see who you're talking to. But post-pandemic, it's all about the Zoom, so you could actually see the face of the person you're talking to. What a lovely face it is to see you on this Tuesday morning.
Well, it's why I got into radio, so no one had to look at me. And now I'm stuck putting my face everywhere.
Truth, man. I was one of my favorite things about podcasting, because I've been podcasting since like 2007. So one of my favorite things about it was like, my God, this is, you can roll out of bed. You don't have to take a shower. You don't have to be publicly presentational. But Zoom has changed all that, man, where I was like, I better wash my face before I get on Zoom with Taz and Jim, for heaven's sakes. I don't want people to see sleepers in my eyes.
You look great, buddy. You know you're looking good. Thanks. You're feeling good. We've been following along since your heart attack, your lifestyle changes that you've made. Walking a lot, eating the right food, basically what did it for you?
I went vegan. That was the biggest thing, man. Absolutely walking every day and whatnot. Like I try to do about 4 miles every day. Going vegan really changed everything. And it's certainly not me trying to recruit. I don't work for any vegan movement. But in going vegan, it eliminated most of the foods that like kept me heavy as well. It's not to say that you can't eat potato chips. You can still do that. And sugar is vegan as hell, so you still have to be careful. But like cutting out all the animal products, dairy and just meat, like weight just kind of fell off, combined with, more motility in my life, walking around and stuff. So it's been beneficial. And this is probably the time of life that I needed it the most. Like I'm 52, for heaven's sake. So I guess throughout my late 20s and all through my 30s and heavens, even into my 40s, being heavier was something I never thought about until I almost dropped dead from a heart attack. And so now all I think about is longevity. I got early success in my life, at age 23 is when everything happened with Clerks and whatnot. And you think you're going to live forever. And then one day your body reminds you, oh, no, you're not. Your body is a temple and whatnot. Start treating it like such. So because of that, I had to go healthy. It certainly wasn't like I lived in Los Angeles for, I think, 18 years at that point, and like never occurred to me to be health conscious and whatnot, even though you're surrounded by.
Yeah, it's like health conscious that is culture. LA's mantra, right?
That's it. And I was, I was a heavy dude amongst really thin people and whatnot. And you tend to not think about your weight when they call you big guy instead. Everyone's always like, hey, big guy. And I always assumed it was like, oh, I'm the big guy because I make movies. That's why. But, it was more about the size. And there's a reason I wore hockey jerseys for as long as I did. And I love hockey, don't get me wrong. But hockey jersey acts as a fat guy's moo-moo, man. It's like you can grow or shrink under it. Nobody can really tell what your size is. It's just a garment that goes down like that. So recently I got my own movie theater, the Smyde Castle Cinemas, where I'm at right now, downstairs the movie theater, upstairs the apartment. And before all the screenings, we do these auctions every night where we sell off memorabilia and sign stuff. So I've been like selling my old jerseys to fans that want to buy them. And it's like, every time I'm holding one up, I was like, this is a 4XL AK jersey. this is at one point I was wearing an 8XL goalie cut jersey and stuff. So yeah, it's now I can fit into an XL if I needed to.
You've been working on your mental health as well. I've been seeing some articles about it's got to go hand in hand. Do you think you can properly get in shape mentally if you don't get in shape physically?
I mean, I got in shape physically and never dealt with the mental stuff. I mean, that's the thing. Most of us never deal with the mental stuff at all. And in my case, it was like, don't complain. Like everything is going well. You got a dream job. Like, what are you going to talk about your traumas for and stuff like that? And so I tended my whole life to just minimize my traumas. That's how we live. That's how people live day to day when they go through something traumatic. And everybody goes through traumatic stuff all the time. Sometimes it's very large, sometimes it's not as large, but size doesn't matter, at least in the world of trauma. Sex, that's a different thing altogether. But like in the world of trauma, like trauma is trauma, as they taught me at the mental health facility where I was. So it doesn't matter if, like, you know, you've seen your best friend shot in the face, or if, you know, your teacher called you fat in front of a classroom full of people. To change that, to be like, well, mine is less than that person's, is unhealthy, man. The human nervous system doesn't differentiate between levels of trauma. It's, you know, the same, seeing somebody get killed or feeling like an emotional hurt hits the body the exact same way. So that's the one thing I've learned over the course of the last, let me see, I was in Sierra Tucson, I got in February, so March, April, May, June. It's only been 4 months almost since I got out of the nut house and stuff. And what I've learned is to, you know, kind of be honest, embrace things, deal with it. I was part of a generation that was like, you didn't really show emotion. Like, I'll give you something to cry about. That was something we all heard as kids when I was a kid. It's not a healthy way to be, man. Like, so now I'm just very open about it. I've always kind of openly processed everything in life, whether it be my career, whether it be, you know, the weird people I've worked with, whether it be the heart attack. And now with the mental health stuff, it felt like the same thing. Like, it's always best for me to talk about it and normalize it, take the stigma out.
I see you were picketing the writer's strike that's going on right now in the U.S., which is going to affect the industry up here in Canada. You know, our Hamilton audience, a lot of films are shot in Hamilton and our listening area. Eventually, things are going to slow down. What's the mood like on the picket line down there?
Rightfully so. All the folks are interested in, like, we're working for these streamers, and the streamers make billions. Like, in the case of Netflix, they make, like, I think the estimate was like $700 million to $1 billion a day based on subscriptions worldwide and stuff. And, you know, it's an expensive company to have to run, but that means there's a lot of profit. But they made a deal with the Writers Guild years ago before streaming began that, you hear that parade? That's Memorial Day parade right outside my window.
Happy
right
Memorial Day, by the way.
Even though this
is Tuesday.
It's Tuesday, kids. It's absolutely Tuesday, but you can hear that parade outside. That's what it's like in America, Taz. We just have parades every damn day. Yeah. Just because it's Tuesday, we celebrate.
It's still going.
So it is, it's what they're doing is righteous in terms of, like, trying to get a fair shake. I know some people are like, oh, Hollywood sucks and all the writing is terrible and these people don't deserve any more money and stuff. But it's like any job. The time you put in, you want to be compensated, particularly if, like, what they're making off of what you're doing results to a lot more money. That being said, the mood on the line, like when you're out there picketing, is celebratory. You're running into people you haven't seen in a long time. You're meeting people you've never met before. I met Drew Goddard, who ran the first season of Daredevil on Netflix.
Love
Brian K. Vaughan, who's a massive comic book writer.
Yeah.
These are cats that, like, I probably never would have come across in my regular life. And, you know, not every writer is recognizable. I've smeared my face across the pop cultural landscape for like 30 years at this point. So people are like, oh, that's Silent Bob. He also writes and directs. But a lot of other writers have never done that. So, like, they're kind of anonymous. So, you know, I was sitting there having a conversation with Drew Goddard and Brian K. Vaughan. I didn't even know who they were until me and my friend Mark Bernardin walked away. And I was like, who were those guys? And he told me. And I was like, why didn't you tell me, man? I'm a huge fan. So luckily we ran into him again. I was able to blow him up and stuff about what they've done. But it's been good, man. Like, there's been a lot of appreciation from the baby writers out there or unknown writers. For me even showing up, they're like, thanks, man. You're putting a spotlight on this. A lot of them are just like, well, you're part of the Illuminati. Like, what's going to happen with this strike? And I'm like, why am I part of the Illuminati? They're like, you're well known. I was like, these two things don't necessarily equate and whatnot. I do have the benefit of, if I can't write because of the Writers Guild, I could pivot and do a number of other things to put food on the table, like going up to Brantford and doing a Q&A and whatnot. That's something that's rarefied breathing that, like, not other writers don't have that luxury to pull that off. I own the movie theater, so I could do shows here. I own a comic book store for 26 years. So there's always money coming in from someplace and whatnot. And, you know, to be fair, I entered the business as a filmmaker, but, like, now I make more money standing on a stage talking about making films than I actually do making films at this point. So, you know, I'm breathing that rarefied air, but like, you know, it's solidarity to go down there and pick it with the writers that don't have it as good as me and don't have as many options as I do. And, you know, it looks like SAG might be joining the fight and DGA as well. So, and if those two organizations join, then the shutdown will end almost immediately. But right now, like, writers are so devalued that like ABC came up with their fall lineup and they just replaced everything with reality programming, which doesn't fall under the Writers Guild. So they're ready. Like, you know, you were talking about the productions that come up to Hamilton. They'll go for a while longer because things have already been written. But once they've run out of the written material, then the work kind of dries up unless they're up there shooting a reality show or something like that. So it's scary for a lot of folks where writing and words are their only means of making a living. So I hope that the strike ends as quickly as possible. If not, for no other reason, if not just for them, so they can go back to work and put some food on the table and stuff.
You mentioned you're out there with Mark Bernard, and a big fan of your podcast, Fat Man Beyond. I have to say, one of the greatest episodes of any podcast that I have listened to after Stan Lee passed away, listening to you talk about your experience getting to know that man who's such a big part of so many people's lives. I mean, you know, I grew up reading comic books as an escape, listening to Stan Lee's voice before the animated Spider-Man show would start, Spider-Man and his amazing friends.
Yeah.
And, you know,
hey, Spider friends, this is Stan Lee. You know, the voice of the show.
You don't realize what a big part of your life someone like that is until they're gone. You had the luxury of being a fan who got to have a relationship with him, and hearing you basically eulogize him was something that was pretty special, man.
That means the world, man. That was one of my favorite episodes we ever did. It was what Mark described as, what did he call it? He goes, an Irish wake for a Jewish legend. And we all sat around loving on the guy. It was kind of healing. I remember I saw or spoke to Kevin Feige, who runs, like, you know, the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Of course, yeah.
Shortly thereafter. And, you know, I he gave me a shout out for that. He's like, I've watched that episode of Fat Man Beyond. And he goes, like, it was nice to be able to kick back and listen to you guys talk about Stan, eulogize Stan. Yeah, that was absolutely one of the better episodes we did. Fairly emotional, but also like very celebratory. You know, the man had a long, wonderful life in which he emotionally and touched folks and entertained them for years. And he believed in his medium in a big, bad way. He would be the guy out there tub thumping for comic books in the 70s when people were like, you're a grown man, stop talking about comic books. He saw the future, and we're living in a future that he saw way back in the day. So I miss him. Working with him was always wonderful. Just having him as a friend was crazy. Anytime I'd show up at Comic-Con, we'd cross paths, he'd be like, Kevin. He always remembered me, never remembered Jason's name. So like, I'm always with Jay Muse and stuff, and he'd be like, hey Kevin,
that buddy. Guy
so, yeah. Jason Muse put him in a movie. I think Stan's last performance was in a movie Jason made called Method in the Madness. And that was the day when he got to set. He was like, Jason, thanks for having me in the movie. And Jason's like, he remembered my name.
he lived up to the hype. Stan Lee, getting to know Stan Lee. Just a great father figure, grandfather figure for so many. Another guy like that from Brantford, Ontario, Walter Gretzky, who I've had the pleasure of spending time with over the years. And I've seen him interact with hockey fans and not leave a room until he takes multiple pictures with every kid, signs every piece of paper for every kid in that room. And it's so cool. As a Wayne Gretzky fan, Gretzky family fan, that you're coming up to Brantford, Ontario this weekend for the Walter Gretzky street hockey tournament. It's been a while since you've been there. Are you going to be playing in the tournament this weekend as well?
Oh, heavens no. At age 52, I know there are people that can pull off athletics, you know, at mid-century and stuff, but might be a little too risky for me. Health-wise, I could certainly pull it off better than I did when I first went up there. I've been thinking about Walter a lot lately because the whole reason I went to Brantford ever in the first place, and we did two shows at the Sanderson Center back in the day, that was called Stocky Night in Canada because I was much heavier. this time I'm coming up on Friday to do Schlocky Night in Canada because I felt like Stocky would be a bit of a missell, if you will.
Also, anytime you have a chance to use the word schlocky, you got to use it.
Yes. It describes my entire body of work. But the whole reason I started engaging with that area was because of my fandom for Wayne Gretzky, but my fandom for Walter Gretzky grew even more immensely than my fandom for his kid. I remember before we did that street hockey tournament, we were trying to like break a Guinness Book of World Records because Victoria had it for like the most teams enrolled in a street hockey tournament or something like that. And me and Walter crossed the country and did interviews like from Vancouver all the way back to Toronto to try to get a bunch of people to come out like nationwide. And the point was like our sell was like, look, Wayne Gretzky has broken a lot of records. He don't need to break another one. But Walter Gretzky, this is the one record he would like to break. And we did. We were able to get him into the Guinness Book of World Records the year that we did it. So knowing him, going to Variety Street, the house that Wayne grew up in, going to the basement and seeing all the trophies, like, was breathing rarefied air. But if you lived in the area or if you ever just bombed by his house, he would bring you downstairs and show you all the trophies. He was Canada's dad.
Oh, he loved it. Yeah.
He did. He was so proud, as he was of his son's accomplishments. He's just a proud Canadian, worked for Bell forever and stuff. I miss him. He was such a good guy. When he passed, it was so heartbreaking. But I saw him, let me see, a couple years back, my friend Malcolm Ingram, who lives up in Toronto, was shooting the documentary Clerk, and I popped by the street hockey tournament, not to play, but just to be up there. And that was the last time I got to cross paths with Walter and talk to him. And he was such a wonderful, wonderful man. So as I was getting ready to come up on Friday to do the Schlocky Night in Canada, I've been thinking about Walter quite a bit, man. So, you know, the show will definitely be done in his honor and his memory.
You mentioned Clerk, a documentary about your life. It's available if people want to watch it up here on the Crave Network. Sean Stanley is one of our listeners, and Sean just wanted me to remind everybody they can watch that documentary that he edited on Crave.
And let me tell you something, I ain't taking anything away from the director, Malcolm Ingram. He's a dear friend of mine, and he's made wonderful docs. Most of them gay themed, like Small Town Gay Bar, Out to Win. Proud Canadian. He's been to TIFF, Sundance, South by Southwest, a really strong filmmaker. But every documentary is made or broken by the editor. And Sean did an amazing job with Clerk. You know, I've got, by the time they made that documentary, I'd been doing stuff for 25 years. There are any number of places you could have gone. And having all the interviews, having to go through and figure out, like, not just what all the talking heads who weren't me had to say, but me. I sat for hours of interviews. So between him and Malcolm, like, picking out the interviews, and then Sean building all the stuff around, deep diving onto the internet, pulling up old footage to put into the doc, I always thought he did an incredible job. I like to think of myself as an editor on my own films, but I only shoot what I need. So when I edit my films, it's like putting together a child's puzzle of 50 pieces or something like that. Sean had 25 years to kind of go through and put that together, and he did such a phenomenal job. I love that documentary so much. One of the last times I was up in Toronto was we were up there showing that documentary.
It would stink to have a documentary about your life that you hated.
I know, right? And I bet you it happens to people.
I'm sure it does.
Process of elimination, it's got to happen. But I was lucky enough that a really great friend of mine made it, one of my best friends. And that the documentary, I didn't have to just say nice things because he was my friend. Like, it was truly a testimony to my life. You know, I felt like, wow, that is the journey, you know, and as much as you could fit into 2 hours, to say the least.
Kevin Smith is with us. Have you seen the new Flash movie, Kevin?
Oh, not yet, man. I was supposed to go to CinemaCon to see it last month because I own a movie theater, as I repeatedly mentioned, Smodcastle Cinemas in Atlantic Highlands, New Jersey. So as an exhibitor, you know, I've worked on the other side of film as a filmmaker, but now as an exhibitor, as a guy that actually has a theater and shows movies, you can go to something like CinemaCon without being there to promote a movie or something like that. And CinemaCon is big for the big movies. So I never went to, it used to be called Show West back in the day. I never went as a presenter for like one of my flicks. So this was my first opportunity to go as an exhibitor. Like, I was able to sneak in the exhibitor door. But sadly, my mom got sick and she's been in the hospital for the last 8 weeks. She gets out on Tuesday, thankfully. And when she was in the hospital at her absolute worst is when CinemaCon was going on. So I had to ditch out of it. So I didn't get to go to the Flash sneak preview screening that they had there. So they've been having influencer screenings and, like, you know, I saw Stephen King got to see it.
Yeah, he said,
like,
he loved it.
I don't watch he loved it. He's like, I don't watch superhero movies, but I loved it. And I'm like, well, I watch superhero movies. Why aren't they showing me? They showed it to the Russo brothers, which makes sense. They made Avengers Endgame. But so far, I've not been asked. I haven't gotten into a screening or anything like that. So I was like, Warner Brothers must hate me. And then last week, I just got an invite to the premiere on June 12th. So June 12th in Los Angeles, I'll be seeing it. And then June 15th here at 15th, 16th, and 17th here at Smod Castle down in Jersey, we're going to do a series we do called Watch with Kev, where you watch the movie with me and I get up and do a Q&A for a movie I had nothing to do with. So I'm going to be watching it many, many times. All I hear from people I trust who've seen it already is how wonderful it is. But, you know, step everything aside, it's got two of my favorite Batmen in it. It's got Batfleck, who's a guy that I've worked with like 9 times, but it's got my Batman from before I was ever a filmmaker. It's got Michael Keaton back in the bat suit.
Do you remember seeing that movie for the first time? I remember my mom let me go with James Grayson downtown Capitol Theater, you know, the old dilapidated theater. And it was life-changing, that film.
To go see a Batman movie with a kid named Grayson.
That's true.
I remember going to see it, ironically, not at this theater. I saw it at a movie theater that has long since been torn down. The movie's at Middletown. There's a Target there now. But I was working at Domino's Pizza Parlor. It was the first day, and I was a trainee. And they made you wear an outfit. One of the last jobs I ever had where I had to wear like a uniform and stuff. They made you wear like these slacks, these blue slacks, and of course the shirt. And I was there for 4 hours, and there were other trainees. And meanwhile, Batman, June 23rd, this was 1989, was opening like 3 parking lots over. And my friends Brian and Walter were going, and they were like, you're not going to be here? I was like, I'm working, I can't go. So I remember the folks at Domino's were like, we have too many trainees tonight. Who wants to go home? They couldn't even finish the sentence before I was like, I'll go. And I instantly, like, there were no cell phones, bro. So I had to like get to a pay phone. I had to call Walter to be like, save me a seat, man. I'm going to be able to go. And we watched it in a packed theater, about 300 people. And it was astounding, man. And you got to remember, this was at a time where nobody was doing comic book movies. And it sounds so weird to say now, but like when we all saw Batman, we were like, that's the most realistic version of Batman
totally.
They've ever done.
And now it's like how I was terrified of the Gremlins when I was a kid. I was like, oh, those Gremlins are gonna get me. And now you can almost see the guy's arm operating the puppet when you watch it, right?
Oh my god.
Back
Lord,
then it looked real.
It looked real, and especially now considering like all they do with the Batman movies now, with the exception of seemingly with this new Flash film, is everyone tries to make it as real as possible. Matt Reeves, the last Batman movie, did The Batman. And it was all about, like, this is what Batman would be like in the real world, man. This is as close to reality as possible. And this is a character that doesn't hold up to scrutiny of reality. Because even if your parents were killed in Crime Alley and you wanted to avenge them and you were a multi-billionaire, why would you ever wear a cape to a fight? Why would you ever cut off your peripheral vision with a cowl
or not
like that?
Be able to move your neck like
or constantly be stiff fighting like this? I saw Batman Returns when I was at the Vancouver Film School in 1992. The year that came out, I was up in film school. I saw it with Scott Mosier. Whenever I think of Michael Keaton Batman, I think of two places. I think of that Middletown movie theater, and I think about being in Canada when it opened up. And there was a very nice Canadian fan at one of the last things I did who brought me this poster that the drugstore up there. I forget, but it's written on the corner of the poster.
Shoppers Drug Mart, maybe?
It was a Shoppers Drug Mart poster. Thank you. And it's this giant poster, life size, of Michael Keaton for Batman Returns. And it hangs in the hallway just right outside the store.
That's great. Well, I was just curious to know if you cried during after the Flash movie. That's my big test, whether or not I want to see a comic book movie. Did Kevin Smith cry
Kevin
after?
Smith tear, the tear test, to say the least. I fully intend to. The trailer made me emotional.
Yeah.
Seeing Michael Keaton, like, you know, not even in the suit, which was astounding, but seeing it, like hearing him in that one, and I think it was the second trailer, where he's like, you know, talk about like when my parents died.
Yeah.
I spent my life fighting crime in an effort to bring it back, bring them back. And you did it. Like, even that was like, oh my God, that's not just Batman talking about his parents being killed in Crime Alley. That's Michael Keaton Batman.
Yeah.
Like, we never got a Batman. We did get a Batman Forever, but Michael Keaton wasn't in it. We didn't get a true Batman trilogy with Michael Keaton. We got him twice, and then he never wore the suit again. So this Flash movie is giving us, those of us who, you know, who are old enough to have been around for the first Batman to care about it as much as we do, the chance to see that third Batman movie that he never got to do. So I guarantee you I'm going to cry. There's a shot in the trailer which really does it for me emotionally. I think it's the second trailer, or maybe it's one of the TV spots, where a bunch of people are firing guns and he throws up the cape as like a bulletproof vest. Oh, oh.
Don't cry now, Kev. Come on.
I feel it coming up in my throat. We also live in the age now where, like, you know, back when he did Batman, it was very limited action, especially because he couldn't turn his head. But now CG Batman Michael Keaton can do anything. He can fly up in the air and throw a dude down and break his back. I can't wait, man. And I hear he's in the movie a lot. Somebody who saw it told me, like, he comes in at the halfway mark and he's there for the whole ride.
That's great.
So I'm there. I cannot wait. That's the movie that I'm looking forward to the most. We're going to make a movie this summer if the DGA and SAG doesn't strike, right here at this movie theater, called the 4:30 movie. I'm looking forward to The Flash more than making my own movie.
Well, honest. I'm glad I brought it up. I kind of felt bad asking you about someone else's movie.
No. Look at the joy.
Yeah.
Look at the fandom. Look, before I was ever a filmmaker, I was a film fan. That's what led me to being a filmmaker. And thankfully, that enthusiasm for other people's movies has never gone away. But particularly when you can dial it in to the nostalgia of my pre-filmmaking life. In 1989, I wasn't thinking about making a movie. You know, it wasn't until 1992 or 91 when I saw Slacker, Richard Linklater Slacker, that I was like, maybe I could make a movie too. So in 1989, when Batman comes out, I'm just a movie buff. I'm just a comic book kid and a movie buff who saw one of the greatest movies he could possibly see. So for them to be able to take me back to that moment pre-career and let me just bathe in being a pure fan, like, I'm not going to be sitting there in the audience watching that movie going, well, I would have done it differently as a filmmaker. I'm just going to be sitting in that audience like going like, I can't believe he's back. I can't believe he's saying things as Batman. I can't believe he's wearing the suit. It just, you know, the older one gets, this is why they keep making these comic book movies. The easiest way into our hearts and wallets is nostalgia.
Yeah.
And
whether it's music, movies, whatever it is, it takes you back, you know, and you realize the value of that currency the older you get.
I saw a tweet, man, that I thought was really funny. And there was a kid, obviously, who was talking about, like, all these people, these old people, and I guess I was one of the old people he's talking about, are looking past the Ezra Miller controversy just because they want to watch a 70-year-old man dress up like Batman. And I was like, yes, that's yes, I do want that more than I had any idea in my life that I wanted something. I want to see that 70-year-old man dress up like Batman again.
Well, your films, obviously, your fan base, you know that your films have made people feel the way that you felt about Batman over the decades. And a lot of those fans are going to be at the Sanderson Center on Friday night in Brantford, Q&A, so you'll have the open microphone. People can come up, ask you whatever they want.
Absolutely. Well, they dictate the evening, man. I don't come with a set list or something like that. It's whatever the audience wants to talk about. And I'm pretty damn candid and always willing to talk about whatever. In a world where I, you know, put out a video talking about how I went crazy, there's no topic that I won't touch on stage. Sadly, I will not have seen The Flash by that point, but I'll still be sharing my enthusiasm for it and whatnot. So anything the audience wants to talk about, come armed with Canadian Qs. I'll bring American A's.
Still a few tickets remaining for Schlocky Night in Canada, an evening with Kevin Smith. Pleasure talking to you today, sir. Enjoy the View Askew teams in the tournament this weekend. I'm sure you're looking forward to seeing all those guys again.
That's right. The View, the Vashel, the View Askew Street Hockey League, like, they all first came up with me when I went for the first time and I brought my team, Puck U. And then a league, thanks to, like, one of my friends, Daryl, a league has built up around that first time we ever went. And so every year, even when I haven't gone, the Viewaskew Street Hockey League team has gone. So I'll be there rooting them on in spirit. I'm also going to be at Capped Can Comics that day, earlier that day, doing a comic book signing because I got a bunch of my own comic books out at this point. They're in Mississauga, I believe. So I'm going to be there from 1 till 4 tagging comic books, signing whatever people bring in. Then I'll be on the Sanderson Center stage that night. It's going to be a wonderful day up in Ontario, man.
Kevin Smith, enjoy your summer. I'll be watching your review of The Flash when it comes out.
You'll be seeing tears for sure, Taz. You know, you'll be like, why is this grown man crying? But, you know, I used to, before I talked about going into the mental health facility, I would post pictures of myself crying and stuff. Now that I've lost my mind, hopefully people will be more forgiving if they see me crying.
This is the Taz and Jim Podcast.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.